shadows cast by rainbows. There you will meet the sage, feeding rabbits bits of lettuce or cleaning out the cage. He can give you more direction than you've ever known. Show you your bronze baby shoes now. My, how you have grown. Won't you go exploring? You got to find some truth. You can't spend one more day of Christians shouting down at you. You say you don't dig politics, that never was your bag. People who could run for office wave their private flag.
Welcome to another edition of the Sunday Forum here on WMNF 88.5 Tampa, Sarasota, St. Pete. This is your host, Walter L. Smith II, along with the member of the Fourth Estate, Mobili. What's happening, man?
Good morning.
All right.
Not too much is happening yet.
Yeah. Not too much, man. But we're waking everybody up, though.
Yeah, as soon as we wake up.
We gotta wake up. We gotta wake up. We gotta wake up, everybody. Wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. I think, you know, I saw a documentary about Rick James. And let me tell you, man, it was really, you would think it's funny my saying this, it was inspirational.
Okay.
That man led a very rough life, man, very rough life. One of my favorite songs is one that you hear on this show a lot, Fired Up.
Okay.
Yeah. Fired Up is one of my favorite songs. You know, the typical stuff. I like the Mary Jane Girls, the ladies that he actually produced. And he produced so much music. He got a lot of stuff done.
Yeah, he did.
Got a lot of stuff done.
Certainly.
Oh, man. But he had a very stormy life. Very stormy life. And he wasn't the best father, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He insisted on keeping his children and raising his children to the best of his ability. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, that included them being up in their rooms when parties were going on. His sister said, his daughter said that she would come down early in the morning and after the party's over with to go to the kitchen, and she'd be stepping all over bodies and stuff.
I couldn't believe it.
Like, wow. Wow. But let me tell you, really, really enjoyed that. A lot of good stuff coming on Netflix. Dave Chappelle has a special that he's been, that has been done. He says this is last special. He says it's last special. What do you think?
I don't think so.
No?
I think it's hype. Just to keep him in the public mind. I don't know. I hope not. I hope he's not going away again.
He says he's going to go on another hiatus.
I hope not. I think that's just
hype. I think that's hype. I don't think he's going to do that. I really don't. I think I believe you on that one. Let me tell you, this was a very, very good special. I really, really enjoyed it. So I recommend if you're going to watch Netflix, please watch the Dave Chappelle, comedy show. Please check it out. That was really, really good on Netflix right now. Folks, let me tell you, we have another stage play, the same stage play that I've been announcing every Sunday. And this is Tell 'Em I'm Gonna Make It. Tell 'Em I'm Gonna Make It. It's written by Dr. Sean L. Smith, written, produced, and directed by Dr. Sean L. Smith. It'll be held November 13th. Show starts at 7:30 p.m. 7:30 p.m. For more information, call
802-792-8995.
802-762.
And put those bifocals on.
I don't want to. 8995.
Okay.
Dr. Sean L. Smith. Tell him I'm going to make it. Tell him I'm going to make it. Gospel stage play. Check it out, folks. Check it out. Listen, we have a very, very special show today. And this is a show that, this is the third part of the series. And this is, this show is going to be about Mandela and Me. Mandela and Me, which last week it was Up to the Bottom. The first week it was The Talk.
The Talk on survival and slavery and Jim Crow.
Yes, and each one has a message of, survival and triumph.
Yeah.
And it's written, this is a series of books, a three-part epic, as I call it, three-part epic, like Roots. Roots was one part. This is three parts.
A mini-series.
A mini-series. I think it's mini-series a bowl.
Yes.
Right? Yes. I would say. And this is going to be, this is written by my mom, Attorney Geraldine Williams.
Yeah, and I liked the last week when she said that it was not just she came up from the bottom, but she said she came up to the bottom of her profession.
Right. And of life, as it were, around her, right?
Yes.
To have to still go up the ladder.
Right.
You know, in these things. Right. So there's symbols and symbolisms of struggle.
Yes.
That you'll find in these books.
Struggles and triumphs.
Yeah, struggles and triumphs that you'll see in these books. The conversations that we've had have been tremendous. Everything from the genealogical discussion and how the research was done to go back to find the little girl from Nigeria from whom we derived.
Right.
Who we descended. Her name is Moroyo. And which is a fictitious name, but the girl actually existed.
Exactly.
Right? Because we're right now, we're trying to find out what that name really was.
Right.
But still, if we can. But right now, you know, we take what we can.
That's right.
But everything in that book is factual. Everything in that book, in these books, are factual and based on research that was actually done. And on her life, from her perspective, what happened? What she's been told, stories that she's heard from relatives and things like that, and things that she researched and found out whether they were true or not, and she brings them to this book, to this literary piece that I believe is going to be very, very pieces that I believe are going to be very, very successful. And I'm not just saying that as her son. I'm saying that I believe because there are a few books that actually are written in this Haley-esque manner. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think there's a story in all of our families that can be written in the Haley-esque. And the fact that Attorney Geraldine Williams has done it is a shining example now that we can all follow. And I think that we all have that story to tell. And that's why this has been fascinating. And that's why I think we've been getting a lot of calls surrounding these interviews. Because mm-hmm. this is a story that we all have in our hearts. But because of the nature of white supremacy, we don't have the names. So it's going to take some research, but I think the idea of personalizing our history in this way is a undertaking worth taking.
Absolutely.
And Geraldine Williams will be a beacon in that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So from that perspective, thanks, Ma. And she's going to be on this morning as our guest for the third and final interview. Well, it won't be the final interview. This is the final interview for these books, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So listen, you know what I need everybody to do? First of all, do you have any diasporic news?
Not at the moment, but we can certainly look for it. I've been searching through the AP news, but I can say this, that the Ethiopian-Eritrea issue did come to the attention of the United Nations on the week.
Oh, finally.
Last week, yeah, because, you know, these are issues of human rights. And so that is an issue that has finally come to the attention of the world and in the guise of the United Nations. And we're also looking at the continuing vaccine inequality that is going on. We know that viruses mutate. And if you are on one of the poorest continents in terms of the historical nature of how supply chains have worked, that continent has always been left out.
Right.
Even though it's the largest continent, even though historically it has fed the rest of the world, mm-hmm. that continent, the people who live on the continent, don't get the benefits of their own resources. And so the world, in the guise of the UN, has been looking forward to trying to get rid of the vaccine inequality, because we'll never get out of this vaccine nightmare. I mean, this pandemic nightmare without the vaccines being given to everybody around the world.
Wow. Let me just say, I didn't want the day to pass without saying that this week will commemorate the assassination on the 15th of this month in Burkina Faso. African leader Thomas Sankara was assassinated on the 15th of October in Burkina Faso. Thomas Sankara was very young.
He
was like 30-some years old, I think. And what gets me about his presidency was it was really revolutionary.
Yeah.
And it worked. He was president twice.
Yes, he was.
Twice. Assassinated the second time, obviously. But it was one that was very revolutionary. And it was definitely worth reading about, worth knowing about Thomas Sankara.
Yeah.
Please, folks, if you don't know about Thomas Sankara, he was one of our great African leaders, of Burkina Faso. All right, so I think we need to wake everybody up, man.
Mm-hmm.
What we got? We got fired up. We got some fired up.
Yeah, we were just playing that a little bit. Right now, we're on Tribe Called Quest.
Let's play. All right, let's do it. We're
doing this Tribe Called Quest right now.
Sweet aroma. Let's do this.
So, in the meantime, we do have some phone calls coming in.
All right, what we got?
Let's see what we got here. We are taking your telephone calls. Of course, this is the Sunday Forum. 813-239-9663 is the number to call. And looks like someone has something to say. Go ahead, caller. You're on.
Caller?
Good morning, gentlemen. Can you hear me?
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, hi, this is Chris Steiner in Clearwater. I'm well, thanks. Hey, Walter, I was really glad to see that you had the conference with Eric Crown and Nikki Fried and I can't remember. I'm trying to
with the yes about the phosphate, the movie, the documentary known as Phosphate, Phosphate, written by Eric Crown, and it was an excellent time. I enjoyed the actual documentary. It was very telling. Finally, there's someone out there saying some of the things that I've been saying for years regarding how to deal with some of the treachery that we've had to deal with over the years with regard to the phosphate industry and the type of poison that's been literally spewed into communities, into our rivers. And these people have gotten away with it for years. Mm-hmm. Of people getting sick with cancers and so forth.
In the Bay.
Oh man. And it's not just Piney Point. Piney Point was another entity, but we're talking these other places that are out there right now that have been there for years, poisoning people, and it's incredible, man. It's incredible.
Poisoning? Yeah. You mean getting deep into the groundwater?
Oh, getting into the groundwater, the air, the people that are breathing. It's just been,
it's not monitored adequately. It's basically the honor system that Mosaic Phosphate Mining Company is abiding by for Department of Environmental Protection's, very loose regulations. And as Eric Crown pointed out, that he's the producer of that documentary, Phosphate, and he pointed out that they give them a warning before they come in and inspect. But yeah, that is a very timely and I think pioneering documentary. I don't know of any other documentary like it. And it's really important now because I think everybody should, in the state of Florida and beyond, should try to protect our Florida aquifers by going to the November 2nd DeSoto County Commission meeting. DeSoto County is the largest phosphate deposit in North America, that they really want it. And, we don't want us to have them turn into a lunar landscape with what they want is another 14,000 acres they want to rezone to strip mine. And they were beaten in 2018, as I mentioned in the past. I did a show on that on my website. You can go to the June 25th, perhaps maybe July 25th, 2018 show at theliberationstation.com. And then I did a show with Eric September 21st this year on also on my site at theliberationstation.com. And what we need to do is have caravans, people organized to stop Mosaic on November 2nd in DeSoto County Commission meeting to stop their strip mining. And, there's so many reasons. Of course, it's a whole documentary. I won't take your time right now. But in the meantime, I'd like if you could do a show on that.
It's coming.
You get Eric on and talk about so many other great organizations who know much more than I do on this.
Yeah.
Are leading the way and trying to sustain this victory because otherwise we're gonna run out of phosphates worldwide. It's estimated in about 50 years. So
yeah, but you know what? Because we got to get into our show. But let me just say this: we are going to have him in. I have had contact with him via email, and he is going to come on to the show. Keep in mind, of course, that he is deathly ill, and we are praying for him and making sure that he has as much time as he possibly can to do the works that he wants to do. So
he's exposed himself. He's gone into hazardous areas.
Over the years, and he's exposed himself.
We'll help him with that too.
Yeah. I hope the experimental stuff will help him out. So hey, listen. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we'll, you always bring the good stuff, man. We really appreciate your research. But we got to get into the show right now.
Right.
So we appreciate it, man.
And I just want to let folks know, check out Dr. Robert Malone, inventor of mRNA technology, what he has to say about the COVID shots that is very fascinating. That's Dr. Robert Malone.
Okay. All right. We'll have him check it out. Check it out.
Right.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank
appreciate you. It. All right. All right. Is Mom on the line?
I believe so.
I believe so. All right. Here we go. Here we go.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mom.
Hello?
Good morning. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very well this morning, and you?
All right. All right, everybody. This is Attorney Geraldine Williams, my mom, author of The Talk, and author of Up to the Bottom, and the author of Part 3, Mandela and Me. How you doing, Mom?
I'm very well, and I'm so excited to be with you. And Madibi and your listening audience.
She renamed.
That's great.
That thank was, you.
What did you say, Walt?
No, I just said that you renamed him.
Oh, okay.
Mabili, Mom.
You're good.
Yep.
You good? Okay, you're good. You're good. Okay, it's all good. Okay. It's all good.
And
all
more
good.
Callers coming in.
We got calls coming in. Wow. All right. So, they've been waiting, man. They've been waiting. So let's dive into it, Mom. We started out with the genealogical studies that were done. And those studies brought you to a little girl from Nigeria who was brought to the shores of the United States at the beginning of the 19th century. And her name was given Moroyo, correct?
Yes, that's the name that I gave
that
her
you gave
because it means my joy.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm.
She learned some lessons along the way. What were those lessons?
She learned lessons of survival. She was abducted. This is based on history because, of course, we don't know specifically what happened in her situation. And I want to be sure to emphasize that my story is universal and that my beginning is unremarkable in this sense. It wasn't just for Geraldine. Any of us who have African ascendants are in the same situation that I am. In terms of looking back and finding out the origin. So I had a telephone call from my dear friend in Sarasota, Mrs. Grandison, called to say, ask me if I knew this author, I mean this person, and I didn't. And I thought, because she's a big-time FAMU alumnus, I thought that perhaps it was someone who had graduated from FAMU. She said, no, he's an author, and he has written this book, actually. It is a novel. And the novel starts out in a way that's very similar to the way you've started yours out. And I need to say that anybody who reads anything about those of us who originated from Africa will have a similar beginning, because that's the way it was all over. Everybody who had an ascendant who crossed the Atlantic as an enslaved person will have the same kind of beginning. That author's beginning was different from mine. I chose a girl and who was with other girlfriends, and they were socializing. But that particular one that he wrote about was a midwife who was with his child, with her child. And they were abducted. So I thought that was interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. I thought about the midwives after they came over to the plantations, but they actually had midwives there, and that's how he began his. So the story is universal. The actual beginning is unremarkable because we all started in similar ways. We have a need. I really think this is important, to give a shout out to African America, to African men. You and I have been talking from the perspective of the matrilineal line, because I'm the mother, and so I am going back that way. It is so important for all of us, and I have references to this too, to acknowledge the fact that the men who were there on the African continent did not just happen and it was horrible.
Right.
A lot of want children out.
Breaking up, Mom. I think you're breaking up a little bit. But go ahead, go ahead. Let's see if we can straighten it out.
African men, the royal, they were leaders, they were warriors, they were heads of households, fathers, fishermen, hunters, artisans. And then they abruptly attacked. And they
were overpowered because of the gunpowder. Hold on, just a second. Are you in a good zone there?
Are you speaking to me, Walt?
Yes, yes.
Okay, you're having some difficulty.
We're missing a couple of words when you speak.
Okay, I can shift.
Okay, all right. That's a very important point.
Walter?
Yes.
Okay, is that better?
I think so. Let's see.
Yeah, I think that's better.
All right, let's try it.
We can go.
Let's try it.
Okay. All right, I'm talking about the African men.
Yeah.
And we don't want to lose sight on the fact that they put up a fight. They worked, they were coming from a position of strength in their villages. And they were reduced. We have to understand that when the Europeans came, they came with the gunpowder. They came that they had gotten from China, and they had weapons, and they were able to overcome them. So we have to understand that the African men were broken, that their spirits were broken, their wills were broken. They were stripped naked. They were they were beaten with chains. They were they had a kind of experience that no one would want to have. Mm. They were forced to watch their wives and daughters be raped and sodomized. Many of them were sodomized, and their sons were sodomized. And actually, as I was doing my research, I had to go back and read again, make sure that I saw what I thought I saw, that by the time those who did come across were in a state of mental derangement.
Right.
And I said, wait a minute. Oh, yes, they were in a state of mental derangement. And they physically were victims of dysentery. I mean, because of the way they had been living and had been existing on the ships coming over. And this is what they did. The sellers would take their bodies and stuff the rectum with towels or some kind of cloth so that there wouldn't be evidence of their being sick. Because if they were sick, then the value was
sick. Right.
Yes. So I just need to say that while we are taking this matrimonial look, we need to acknowledge this serious attack on the will of the African men. Many of them, they put together a resistance, and some of them even committed a lot committed suicide. They just didn't even want to be bothered with it. So for my African mother, to have survived all of that, I am asserting that her father looked at her and mouthed, survive, comply, survive. And that was the first talk.
Well, call in, folks, 813-239-9663. This is the Sunday Forum. With your host, Walter Osmond II. Our guest this morning is Attorney Geraldine Williams, as we talk about the third installment of a series of books, starting with the talk, the second being Up to the Bottom, and the third being Mandela and Me, which we will be exploring this morning in just a few minutes. We were talking about just now the first book and the second book. The second book talks about the first book. The first book, we spoke about the travel, the transatlantic travel. We spoke about what happened during that travel. We spoke about what has happened, what happened since then, since that travel, which is the talk, the conversations that were had with ascendants of Ms. Williams. And we talk about Cherry Lake. We spoke about Cherry Lake Plantation in Madison County. How did that come about?
That is under continual research. I was told that the girl was at auction. She was purchased by a man whose name was Wyche. Now, I may pronounce it Weish. You may spell it Wash. But it is a name that is from Wales up in England. And there is a Weish, Virginia. I was told that this person lived on a plantation, had a plantation in Virginia. And so the presumption, I'm going to say rebuttable presumption because we're still researching. The presumption is that she was taken to the slave quarters at that plantation in Virginia. Now, it might not have been Weish, Virginia, but it was a Virginia plantation that was owned by by someone named Wyche. I did mention previously that according to Google, there are at least 16 ways to pronounce that name and 16 ways to spell it. And Weish was as common then as is Smith, Brown, Williams, and Jones now. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of Weishes. Then that child was born after the mother was raped by the plantation owner, Weish. And this is another point that we have to pay attention to. When the child was born, the child looked nothing like the mother. So here's this mother who is with this child whose physical features are nothing like hers. Because we have what the Anglos call short and curly hair. We have tones and shades of brown, bronze, ebony skin. And our hair texture is certainly different from that of the Anglos. So this child's hair was kind of a mix. It's curly, not straight, not short and curly. The complexion is very fair, not brown, ebony. And her physical features were sharper than are our broad noses and our thick lips. So this, too, was a change that these Africans had to go through because of those kinds of rapes by the Anglo owners or their sons or their friends, then these children were born. So we had the mulattoes, okay? And then we also had the Africans who were being used to continue the production of slaves in light of the fact that the international communities had stopped the slave trade. So you had some who were if the woman looked like a strong woman and she could work really hard and she could do a lot in terms of production, then she was mated with a man, an African man, who also was strong, and the concept was that, of course, they would create a strong child. And it was so specific that they even knew the ovulation date of of the girls, the African girls on the plantation. This was rough. And I learned, I was very proud to learn this, that the African women actually rebelled against that. They had to produce, I think it was 15 girls from the time that they were, the time that they could begin having a child until the age of 20, they had to produce like 15 children.
Wow.
And it was just time and time and time again. So it was a breeding, a sense of breeding that was unbelievable. So they went through a lot for them to have survived all of that. I want to emphasize that those of us who are here now, we are survivors of the fittest. Only the fittest could survive all of that, and then we are their descendants.
Right.
And then the descendants of this child were brought to Madison County, and they, in turn, were brought to Tampa.
Yes, yes. And I was saying last week that my great-grandmother is quoted in the U.S. Census of 1910 by saying that she was head of household, where there she was there with her grandchildren. So that was here in Tampa, not just Tampa Bay, but in Tampa, yes. And I was born here in Tampa. My mother was born in Alabama. So the sibling of those children who were brought from Madison was my grandmother. And my grandmother moved to Alabama, and that's where my mother was born, in Mobile. Then when that grandmother died, my maternal grandmother died, one of those siblings who came down with her grandmother raised my mother and her younger sister. So that's how my mother was brought into Tampa, and I was born here.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, Attorney Geraldine Williams, author of The Talk, Up to the Bottom, and today we talk about Mandela and Me. So we spoke of the triumphs and the what happened on, was it Wednesday afternoon with you and Grandma?
Oh yes, every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And learning the words colored. White and only.
And only. My first three words that I memorized.
Wow.
And she took me to town, downtown Tampa. She showed those words to me. She had me to say them, had me to spell them, had me to memorize them, and then she taught me what they meant to me and how important that was to my survival. And I was very young. This is before I went to school, and I went to school, started school at age 5.
Wow. Here in Tampa.
Here in Tampa. Here in Tampa.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
There's a lot that that took place. Another important aspect of that period of my life is that when we would leave that setting in downtown Tampa, where I couldn't go here and I couldn't go there and I couldn't do this and I couldn't go do that, then she would take me on the bus from downtown Tampa a couple of miles away onto Central Avenue, where it was the black commercial district of the city. And it was a totally different experience.
Yeah.
So she showed you the contrasts.
She did. She did.
Right.
And my uncle, that's my mother's sister, the younger sister, who was also brought here to be raised by my aunt in my grand aunt here in Tampa. Her husband owned a billiard parlor. We used to call it a pool room. And the billiard parlor was across the alley from the Black Theater on Central Avenue. So I got a chance to go to his billiard parlor, and he would let everybody know that my mother and I were coming in, and everybody had to be respectful of that, and I just loved it. I got free snacks. I got free snacks. And then my mother and I went over to the the theater to watch the, usually it was Western movies. And we did this every week.
Yeah, I find that interesting, the Western thing. I think there were some lessons of white supremacy in Westerns.
Yes. Yeah, I noticed even as a child that, and of course Tarzan, that was another.
Yeah.
That it could be one white man in the jungles of Africa.
Right.
And it could be, you know, several hundred Africans, and he would always prevail. And in the Westerns, the Indians were always defeated by the fewer white men, but they had the gunpowder. That was a difference too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indians were always wrong.
Oh yeah, yeah, and they always lost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But you know, that was our entertainment, and I learned a lot by going with her over from downtown to Central Avenue. The way that the women and the men walked, their gait, was different from what I saw in downtown Tampa. I mean, the men had swagger, and the women had a lot of curvaceous movements. And I mean, it was natural, I could relate to that. I could go over to Roger's dining room and have something to eat or drink. We're downtown Tampa. I could not. Or I could go to Cozy Corner and have one of those hot dogs with the sauce that we haven't been able to identify yet, but it was awfully good. And it was the aroma was totally different. The music that washed through the air that was totally different, and it was an expression of welcome,
right.
and being invited. And so I had both experiences, and I am pleased that I did. I was truly ready for school when I started.
No question about that.
Yes.
No question
about that. What is noteworthy is that my original African mother was forcefully brought over the Atlantic Ocean to the North American continent. I, many generations and years later, voluntarily went in the opposite direction from this continent to the African continent. And I went just because I wanted to travel there to learn about it. But at the time that I went, after finishing school at the universities, that's the University of Florida, Atlanta University, which is now Clark Atlanta University, and Florida State University, I chose to go over and answer the cry for help from Winnie Mandela. I didn't know who Winnie Mandela was, but I could hear her cry, and I could see it on television, and I'm wondering, who is she and what is she saying? But she was saying, free Mandela. And I was like, well, who is Mandela? And so I had a lot to learn, but she was really a terrific advocate, and I thought, my gosh. And then I learned that they were going through what I had experienced, I thought that I could help. Now, you know, I don't know why I thought I had so much going for me that I could help these people. Mm-hmm. Because as I said, I was not hired to go. I was not appointed to go. I was not asked to go. I just chose to go. And I indicated my interest in going, and at that time, now I had been several times before, even before Mandela was released, but at this time I went as a volunteer for the election of Mandela. And you could not go just because you wanted to go. You had to be a part of an NGO, a non-government organization, a group. And so I announced my interest in going. And one of the black legislators in Florida said, now, if she wants to go, I'll see to it that she goes, because we had to pay $8,500 just to go. And, you know, the other people had foundations and firms and all that. I didn't have that. But she saw to it. She got a corporation to make a contribution to the FAMU Foundation for me to travel as a volunteer to South Africa as one of those international volunteers. And so in that respect, that was the beginning of me and Mandela. Because as I said, I had been there several times before, and I saw the transition. I was there during apartheid. And this is interesting, too. Back when I was younger, when Africans would come here to the United States, they would come in all of their regalia, all of their robes, because they were treated differently than those of us who were African Americans. They could go in and sit down and eat where we couldn't. They could go to movies where we couldn't. They had access because they were not of this country, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, when I went over there as an American in South Africa, I was treated as an, what do they call it? Not an unofficial white. There was a, there's a term for it. I'll have to think about it. But that's how they identified us in the passport. We were different from the Africans who lived there and who were natives of South Africa. So we had access to restaurants, to hotels, but they did not. They did not. So it flipped for me. I actually experienced it on both sides.
That's interesting how white supremacy acts.
Yes. I mean, whatever is convenient for him, for them, it worked. But there was a section in Johannesburg where we could go, and it was called the gray section. It was neither black nor was it white. So we could actually live in the hotels, which were really very nice. And we had access to everything, and then black people at section of Johannesburg.
Say that again. Black people.
To the election, where there were to vote for the first time. Mm-hmm. No party. That's the Afrikaners.
Oh, you're breaking up. You're breaking up. I know you were saying National Party, right?
The National Party started in 1948, I believe. And they allowed, of course, the Anglos to vote. And the Indians had some voting privileges. The colors had fewer, the colors being the mixed race people, had fewer voting privileges. But the Africans had none until 1994. Right. And so that's when I went over as a volunteer. And I still have my volunteer badge. I have my shirt, my T-shirt, and some very, very interesting things occurred. Now, I was with a group, very high-end people like Mayor David Jenkins from New York, the president of the National Public Radio, the former president of Nigeria, and I mean, really
high level
American woman and the only woman who was serving as a volunteer on that group. So that was a good experience for me, but I had to be a part maybe two other people. And the driver, and we would go in the mountains. When I say way, I mean really way. There were about 2 million households in Greater Johannesburg. And this is what happened. I went with them, and I told the guys that I would not, because I'm the only woman now. I said, now, I'm not. Don't worry about me. I'm good. I am not going to eat, and I'm not going to drink, because I don't do outdoor toilets and those kinds of things. And I said, I'm okay. Meant I can make it through the day, but the driver was very concerned. So soon thereafter, he said, Jerry, I have a couple that I want to whom I'd like to introduce you. And I said, okay, fine. We went way out, and this couple was a husband and wife, both of whom were educators, and they lived in a red brick house way out in the mountains, lived very nice, and they had a toilet. This is why he took me there. So when I went in, I found them to be very gracious host and hostess, and they were smiling and, you know, offering all kinds of teas and crumpets. And so they had a daughter who was about 18 years old, but she had some mental challenges. Now, there was a day that these people were allowed to come in and vote without any interference. They could come in and vote. And because so many of the Africans were illiterate, they had a ballot that had the pictures of the candidates, and there were a lot of candidates. And I went over with her that and asked her, did she know for whom she wanted to vote? She told me yes. I said, can you point to them? Yes. Okay. And I explained to them what they had to do and when they had to do it. We were about...
You're breaking up again, Mom.
Okay. Now, can you hear me now?
Yes, you hear me now.
Okay. I think I might have been too close. We were about to depart the house when the head of household said, Jerry. Okay, so I thought he was going to get something to show me, you know, maybe he had why he wanted me to wait. But he came back smiling, and it was a family photo album. And he turned to a page in his album that had my picture in it.
Wow.
Yes. Now there are these 2 million households in Greater Johannesburg. And I went
to the one household.
Yes, that's right. And the driver did not know, and I didn't even recognize among Africans, to be exposed to
You're broken up again, Mom. I'm sorry.
Get ready for the National Public Radio anyways, but we're going to take a break.
We're going to come back and revisit that in just a moment.
Okay.
And we got to take a break and come back. But this is a tremendous, tremendous story, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Very historic moment in South African history at the time of the election. First multiracial open election. She was there.
Yeah. I mean, to do the work.
Right.
That's supposed to bring justice to.
Yeah. To the, you know, the black majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The very people, wow, that an injustice was done to, right? Imagine that. Years later, the descendant of that little girl. Wow. Well, folks, listen, thank you for joining us here on the Sunday Forum on WMNF 88.5 Tampa. Sarasota, St. Pete. This is your host, Walter L. Smith II, along with the members of the Fourth Estate. Billy's here with us this morning. Hey, listen, we want to welcome Attorney Geraldine Williams as we talk about her part three, actually, of her series of books. This one is known as Mandela and Me. Very, very interesting piece of work. Tune in, call in, 813-239-9663. We want to hear from you here on the Sunday Forum. And
you can write us, too.
Yeah, you can write this. You can write this. And what is that information?
You can write WalterDJ@WMNF.org.
WalterDJ@WMNF.org. All right. Folks, listen.
Just
check us
DJ.
Out. call in. You can actually listen to us, folks.